We're just gonna sit in silence.
I'm getting everything. I'm zhuzhing things. I think it's just right over here.
This is a new way to start a podcast. Yeah.
Welcome to Talking Too Loud, where we have complete silence.
Yes.
This is our new meditation approach to podcasting.
We're Quakerifying it.
We're Quakerifying, yes. Mm-hmm. Quaker oatsing it. What'd you have for breakfast, Sylvie?
You know what? I didn't have breakfast. Maybe that's why I'm like a
little touchy. A little touchy today.
I wouldn't say touchy. Jeez Louise.
Welcome to Talking July with Chris Savage, the show that's serving up the loudest takes on building businesses, top-notch products, and unforgettable brands. We're here today with Mark Killens, CEO and co-founder of TAC, a media and marketing firm helping businesses align and accelerate their growth. Mark, thanks for being here, bud.
Good to be with you again, Chris. It's been a couple years, actually.
It's been a while.
We go pretty far back.
You guys
go way back, right?
We go way back.
Yeah. 2010.
2010. Wow. Look at that. That's amazing.
That's way, way back.
It's way back. Well, we're here not to talk about the past. We're here to talk about what we're excited about, what we're talking too loud about. And so I have to ask the question, what's got you talking too loud, Mark?
All right. So there's two things. Halloween is coming up and I got three small kids. Two are going to dress up. I guess you could say three are going to dress up, but one is 7 months. So
you'll dress them up.
Yeah, yeah. She's going to be a goat. You know, whatever. She's going to be like, oh, I'm a goat. Cool. But like the other two kids are
Wait, did you say goat or ghost?
Goat.
Goat.
Yes. Yes, a little baby goat.
But the other two kids are going to be Lightning McQueen. Obviously, you know the show, the cars, and, you know, they're very excited about it. I'm going to dress up to be determined exactly what. But like we get 300 to 400 trick-or-treaters. They all sort of downtown trick-or-treats.
Yeah, that's legit.
But that's not the reason why I'm talking too loud. I'm going to throw something at you folks right now. The reason I'm talking loud, and I do talk pretty loud, is the most important thing today is not the message, it's the messenger.
The messenger.
I think it's like the idea that, yes, the way I talk about this is like, people don't just want to hear from brands, they want to hear from people talking about brands. Like, we're filtering our world through people today.
We've been trained.
That's all social media content. You're like, you find someone who you trust on a particular topic. Over time, you trust that person like you trust a friend who would give you a recommendation. And I agree with you completely, Mark. And we've talked about this before, but like it's a huge change. It's something I think most B2B businesses have not picked up on yet. In fact, most are terrified of it.
Most are going the other direction. They're actually using AI as the messenger, which is stupid.
Oh, I love that.
It is, yes. And you're missing the opportunity in a big way to like help people consume, buy, understand, research the way they do for everything else. Like there's great places to use AI, but as like your frontline brand, if you're using it there, you are missing one of the biggest opportunities that exists today.
That's it.
And when you guys talk about the messenger, it's really, you're talking about like a human being who has real things to say and real things to offer versus like an AI bot
or just the company brand itself.
Or just so the like, brand. So okay. I think like, so it's an individual.
When Mark and I got to know each other, like what was working in B2B was Wistia makes a bunch of videos. You see them from Wistia. Everywhere on the platforms you see it says from Wistia. And that was great. But what happened is the platforms matured. They started on the B2B side charging for B2B brands basically to reach their audience. So over time, it's been a shift that happened very rapidly on B2C, which is influencers, creators, right? Where you see an individual person. And if the social platforms limit the reach of the individual people too much, they lose all their content. So they can't do it. So there's a weird thing of like, for them to get a business model that works, they must limit the reach of brands because so brands can pay. But for individuals, they don't. And then when you look at a lot of the social platforms, like you look at TikTok, Instagram, whatever, what everyone's done is now that your audience is effectively potentially everyone globally, they zero in on really specific topics, really specific niches, and become an expert at it. So on everything you're interested in, if you care about cooking with organic food, if you care about like racing fast electric cars, like if you care about electric airplanes, if you care about drone delivery, there's going to be someone who's just like the expert on that thing. And then as a consumer, you find those people, you connect with them, and you start to trust them. Do I trust their recommendations? And so that is so different than how this used to be. And it's not saying that company brands don't matter. They still do. It's just they matter in a different way.
Mark, how did you come to this sort of aha moment?
Studying the shifts that Chris just kind of mentioned, the shift of the internet from a search-centric internet to a social-centric internet, how people search and learn about things, that shift, right? The rise of messaging, which was initiated through the mobile platform revolution, which was initiated through a hardware experience. I mean, lots of different things. COVID had a role in this. COVID accelerated this pretty quickly, I think. But yes, it's about credibility, trust, expertise. Maybe not in that order, but like if you look at any survey that any reputable company's ever done about who do you trust most, it's not brands, right? It's not salespeople, unless you know there's a relationship that's developed there, right? It's people that are your friends. It's people that have expertise, have credibility, other people can vouch for, right? And like B2B, to Chris's point, has not grasped that or has changed their go-to-market to account for this.
It's really interesting. Why do you think that so many brands are like not
embracing it yet?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's like, I'm interested to hear your take, Mark. I think that the one of the challenges here is that, you know, on the B2C side, my favorite example is like gym equipment, home fitness equipment, because I actually follow a bunch
He's
of people.
He's always pumping that iron, man.
Always pumping the iron. But
he looks good.
I think, thank you. But I think the thing that's interesting about that is like, so if you're looking for a creator who's focused on fitness, lots of people care about fitness. They want to look good. They want to feel good. They want to be proud, blah, 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 blah. And so there's a lot of things a fitness person can talk about that are really broadly applicable. Like a lot of people are going to care about fitness who aren't working out. They're going to be like maybe interested in it or whatever. So the audience size potential is very large on the B2C side. It seems at first like the audience potential on the B2B side is smaller. And so there's less of an incentive for there to be creators on B2B. That's what it looks like. But I think what people forget is that actually all these people in B2B, like all these people who have jobs and are want to excel in their jobs, want to get a promotion, want to be more successful at the work that they do, want their company to win, like actually, those people have an extremely strong incentive to learn as much as they can about their discipline to find an edge. And there's actually a pretty big opportunity for creators in the B2B space, but you just have to think about it a little bit differently. And so people think like they have some niche like enterprise software business, so like no one would care about a creator for that. Actually, let's say it's like some niche like cybersecurity for your AirPods thing or something. I'm just making it up. You might think no one cares about it, but there are people who are going to actually care about that. They're going to care a lot. And so your audience size of how you evaluate yourself is different, but the influence that you could have is actually probably the same or even greater. It's just not a thing that people are always talking about. And so this is where we are in the trend today. But I do think it's shifting actually really rapidly. Or I'm starting to see a lot more creators in the B2B space who are figuring this out. And I think over the next few years, we're going to see way more. But I want to know what you think, Mark.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned education. That's one thing. Another thing we just got to call out is like the relatability. Like, can I relate to this person is an underlying thing you just said there too, Chris, you know? But to me, it's part measurement, part status quo, part education. And I'd say the last thing, just being naive. I say just being naive. The education piece comes down to like skill set, because to do this well, you don't necessarily need a lot of money. You need to find people who give a shit. And a great B2C creator influencer, like, you know, maybe they're faking it, but they're pretty good at faking it, but they give a shit. Like, you know, someone, you know, your gym, you know, equipment one, right? Those people, like, you can see and feel the passion of the content they create. In B2B, you got to hire and partner with the right people.
Yeah.
Who are passionate.
Right. Otherwise it like runs the risk of feeling performative and inauthentic. And then it's like, well, you're defeating the purpose.
I think that's right. I think people also B2B, where on the B2C side, you could go look to, if you want to look at the number of people who are fitness influencers, it's enormous, right? It's not five. It's like tens of thousands of people. On the B2B side, I think people don't even know where to look.
Mm.
It's true. It's true. It's very fragmented. But that's one aspect of the change, right? It's you got to partner with people to help your business grow, but you got to partner with a lot of other, you know, types of people and types of organizations to help your business grow. Like if you try to go and bring a product to market alone these days, it is very hard, very expensive for a multitude of reasons. If you want to get into the reasons, we can, but it is like pushing a rock up a hill. So how you think about the ways in which you co-market, co-sell, co-service, co-develop, that has to be like front and center in how you think about growing your business. I'm sure at Wistia, you guys talk a lot about that all the time. Like, how do we partner with the right organizations, the right people, either in those organizations or people that have a small business or just a creator, if you go all the way down the spectrum, and work with them to create joint, you know, value creation and win together. Like, that also is a very big mindset shift.
Let's assume that someone wants to do this. Let's say you're a B2B marketer and you're thinking, hey, I like what they're talking about. This makes sense to me. Where should they go? Like, who should they try to talk to? Should they do it themselves? Should they partner with existing people? How do you think about that?
So the first part in this whole thing is identification. And there's a few places you can look. Number one, you could look at your customers. Wait, I can partner with my customers to help me grow? Of course. The second place, have I built a product for an ecosystem? An ecosystem that's large, right? Could be Adobe, could be Microsoft, could be HubSpot, could be Salesforce. There's others, right, that are now, you know, that are really ecosystem first companies. I could partner maybe not with the ecosystem company, but with other companies in that ecosystem or providers in that ecosystem. Is that third place? Complementary companies selling to my ICP, like the companies that we sell into. Fourth place. Buyers that are complementary. So like meaning, oh, wait a minute, like these buyers have bought similar products. They are kind of experts in this category or space. Let me partner with them. So at a minimum, there's four places you can start to kind of figure out one of those kind of four things when it comes to partnering together. I think you have to identify, and then you have to figure out, we talk a lot about this in the content we produce with TAC. What is the joint value process and prop that's created for you to partner? Like if you and I were going to partner together, like what's in it for you? What's in it for me? But what's in it for the customer? Like people don't spend enough time coming up with the actual unique story or messaging and positioning that is ultimately the foundation for why a partnership is successful or not successful. So I'll stop there. I could keep going, but where do you want to take it?
Well, let's talk about that. How should a B2B company that wants to partner with a creator, who wants to partner with another person to get their message out there in today's world, like how should they think about making that type of content such that it really actually resonates and works?
So you have to interview these creators. You can't just say, oh, this person looks good, I'm going to pick them. Like I would treat when you're working with a creator like you're interviewing someone for your company. And sure, you could take a crawl, walk, run approach when you like interview these people and like, all right, we're going to start with just like one or two LinkedIn posts or posts. But like, honestly, like if you interview them correctly and like you're truly trying to hire them for like 3 or 6 months, 3 months at minimum, if not 6 months, you would have in the back of your mind or right in front of their face a job description and say, here's what we expect. Here's what we want you to produce. Here's what we're going to do. And you lay that out. And you say, great, the first thing we need to develop is a premise and this point of view. And this that ladders up into our brand messaging, our you know, solution messaging, our value-based messaging from our product standpoint. And like wherever we're trying to inject, you could say, this creator, we're going to build a premise, build messaging, build the story, and say, here's how we'll activate that. But it's going to fit into our go-to-market at this level or in this place in the customer journey. And we've interviewed you enough and have done enough research on your audience to say, yeah, we feel great about this. And it's a partnership. And if you want to start small, you can still start small. But I think a lot of people don't even take that first step.
I agree with you. Do you think, in terms of the, let's say you find a creator you want to work with, and you've got a premise that makes sense, and you the topics that they're going to create stuff for, where do you think people should think about putting that? Like, do you put it on the brand's channel? Do you put it on the creator's channel? Do you put it on both? Do you put it on their website? How should people think about that?
It all goes back to what's your hypothesis for success, or where do you need to juice the numbers? Like, looking at your marketing and sales funnel, what number are you trying to solve for? What KPI? And like, what's your hypothesis there? And that's the other thing that people don't do well. Like, they don't think about the outcomes for these things. So for example, if someone's going to charge me $2,000 for a LinkedIn post, I'm going to say no way, because I'll pay you $2,000 if it gets me the outcome. But if it only gets me halfway to this outcome, I'm going to pay you $1,000. That model is so flawed. So for example, if I'm paying someone $2,000 to help me promote a webinar, we're going to agree to say, as part of the relationship, there's a small ongoing retainer. You know, we're going to pay you X amount per month to do this together, to do everything. But as part of these like kind of bigger spike, you know, moments of you're going to try to promote this webinar and get 500 people to sign up for $2,000, which is $4 per lead. Maybe that's too much. Maybe that's too little. If you get that, we'll give you 2,000. If you get half of that, we'll give you 1,000, right? It's a performative based model, which is, that is how literally like B2B or just advertising works, right? Like and that's not applied at the creator level.
Mm.
You're saying treat the creator like a channel, like you would any other channel. Find an incentive to get the message out for whatever message it was going to be to try to drive the outcome, and then incentivize relative to the outcome.
Absolutely. Cool. Absolutely.
Okay. We could go further only on this, but I do have a bunch of other prepared questions I want to get into. So
that's fine.
Okay. From founding Tack to your time at HubSpot, Drift, and AirMeet, you've been deeply involved in growth. What's one surprising thing you've learned about growth that you feel like other people should be paying more attention to?
You can't grow alone. So I've already talked about that. Like, that's, you have to partner with people. You have to both build an audience and a community.
And they're different?
100% different. Like, 100% different. Like, an audience, you know, is paying attention to you. They know you. A community is making a commitment. A member of a community is making a commitment. And is, you know, so I think that, at least that's how I define it, right? Like, there's attention, but then there's commitment. And you need to really focus on what makes both your brand different and your product different. And ultimately, the most important thing is finding the red thread. And maybe we could even play a fun game right now. There's a brand red thread, and there's a value from a product standpoint red thread. HubSpot's red thread, can you guess what the brand red thread was? The one word. It's usually one or two words. Can you guess what it is?
One or two words?
Yeah. It should be pretty obvious. Big event.
Grow better?
No. That's just a tagline. That's a slogan.
But what are you saying for, what do you mean by red thread?
A red thread, yeah. Break that red thread.
Inbound.
Like a...
Inbound is HubSpot's red thread. The value red thread, and you could still maybe say this doesn't hold 100% true today, but it really is. It's leads. They help businesses generate leads. And they, now they help businesses turn leads into revenue, but like, it's leads. You need leads to have revenue. Drifts. The red thread was conversations on the brand side. That turned into conversational marketing. The value red thread is meetings. Comsor, attack customer. Comsor's red thread is networks. Go to network. Their value red thread is introductions. We get people introductions through networks. Can you distill down what you do to that? Those simplest ways. Tax. Our red thread at a brand level is people first. Our value red thread is word of mouth. We help businesses generate more, stronger word of mouth effects, flywheel, channel, whatever, through taking a people first approach.
Interesting.
I like this game.
Yeah, and the earlier on, you can kind of figure this out. As long as your product manifests and aligns to it, and that's proven, I think the better it is typically. Sometimes, you know, it maybe comes a little bit later, but like, if you look at all those examples, those were all created pretty early on in the history of the company.
But I think the other interesting thing about those examples is like the timing, right? Because like, the moment, like, HubSpot wasn't the first place to talk about SEO. They just figured out how to talk about it in a way that people actually understood and that didn't feel like sketchy, right? And it was like SEO was inbound, but it was like you put the right stuff out there and it attracts people to you. But there was the beginning of this massive, massive trend of like the power of Google and the importance of people getting comfortable with it and searching for all these different discrete issues and problems, and the math on like the ads versus the organic traffic itself, which is basically what you were talking about on the people side earlier, which is like, hey, you know, people don't just go to brands anymore. They go to individuals. That's the beginning of a trend. Paying attention to that is really important. And if you can tap into it at this moment and you can enable it, like that's a big deal.
That's true. And then if you can continue to evolve it to make sense as the trend goes through its cycle and you kind of see another thing that you can relate to it as it becomes something bigger than just this idea of like, hey, I built an audience around it and people have attention, but now it means something and people are committing to it. That's when you start to like, you cook with gas, you know?
Totally. And I think it does go back to the brand promise of what, like, because brands, it takes a long time to build a brand, right? Like to build a brand that means something, you're holding a spot in someone's mind when they think about a topic. And so if it's like for us, like empowering people with video, like if you're thinking about video at work, then you're like, oh, yeah, like if I need this solution to video, I'll go to Wistia, but I can't do that with one interaction. Like it has to take hundreds of interactions over a very long time and a lot of trust so that somebody actually, their brain says like, this is a good thing to remember. This is a good thing to pay attention to. And when I'm on this topic, like I should go to them. And it is interesting because it just takes a lot longer, I think, than people realize, but it's also much more powerful when built than people realize.
Agree.
Okay. I want to go deeper on what it takes to build an audience specifically. So what are the types of questions businesses should be asking themselves at the beginning of that process? And in today's competitive landscape, is there a type of content that you think that people should be doubling down on?
So it starts with the problem and a point of view. Right? Like if you're going to build an audience, there's a reason why you would want to build an audience. And it's not, of course, the reason for you is probably money in some aspect, but like, what's the problem? Like what problem are you going to help this audience understand better, you know, learn about, solve, etc.? And that then informs the who, which is like that's what the audience is, right? So, but to do that, you have to find a wedge so that those people, you know, can say, yeah, sure, that's my problem. But like, what makes you different or uniquely an expert to solve that problem? Or like, why, you know, why would I trust you? It goes back to the stuff we talked about before, right? So I think a lot of times we don't think enough about those two things together. And, you know, all of those examples, right? You know, everyone, you know, wants more of the things they need to generate revenue, and how you connect the outcome to the problem to the point of view, like that should be a lot of what you talk about in the first couple years, especially, but on an ongoing basis, the first couple years of any type of business you're trying to do. And this idea of like a minimal viable audience before a minimal viable product, or building a minimal viable product and a minimal viable audience. It's what like Day.ai is doing right now. A lot of companies are doing this right now. They're, you know, Comstor, go back to that example. They're doing this, you know, their product is still in beta technically, and we're building a big audience, right? So yeah, it's that notion. And you can build an audience alone. It's really not recommended. You can't build a community alone. So once you start to realize you have an audience, the question then becomes, how do I want to turn this audience so that, yeah, they, I know who they are. They're a subscriber of something, right? I think Wistia does a great job of helping people become a subscriber to that brand. But then it's like, how do I manifest that attention into a deeper level commitment and relationship? And that's where this idea of you creating some type of ownership of the audience in a way that, you know, works. Like HubSpot Academy, you know, is the classic example that, you know, Chris, you and I talked a lot about in the past, right? Like that opted people in. And the value with HubSpot Academy, the atomic unit that people ultimately cared about that spun that flywheel, was getting certified. The certification was the thing that started the conversations, that started the value creation of like network effect, if you will.
Yeah. For people who don't know that story, just so like HubSpot Academy, can you explain to folks what that is and then the certification specifically? Because it seems like kind of counterintuitive that like getting someone to do all this work would then result in them in the virality element.
So if you don't already know this, you need to know this now. You're not selling software. You're not selling a product. You're selling change. You're selling change and you're selling change management. You're selling a new way to do something. Like no one really gives a shit about that thing. They just want the right change to get that problem solved.
Yeah.
So
they want
HubSpot,
more time in their career. They want more success. They want something they couldn't do before. Or they want to be enabled. Yeah.
To actually though, like get the change with HubSpot, you need to do stuff and you need to understand how to do stuff with HubSpot, AKA the creation of HubSpot Academy. And to validate that you know how to do those things, it's partly through an assessment of you getting certified through a test, but also you using the software. So that's what we created. That's what they do today. To get a certification with Academy, you have to take a test. And in some cases, you have to actually use the software to create real things and outcomes. So that then says, I now have the skills, the knowledge to create the change, thanks to the software, to get to that outcome. So that's the reason why that was so important.
And that had a huge impact on the business, right?
Yeah, I mean, it still does. I just talked to all the HubSpot Academy folks, Courtney Sembler, she's amazing. She leads it now at Inbound. And it's, I think with the core Academy team plus the product team, it's like 100 plus people. It's insane.
Wow.
Yeah.
And, but you knew also that you could see the revenue impact that was having in a very direct way.
Huge revenue impact on the pre and post sale side. I mean, there's an article I wrote, Building HubSpot Academy. You can Google it. It's be the number one result. And it doesn't go through everything. There's a lot of details missed out and there's a lot more that they've done. But yeah, no, it is one of these still, I think it's still the second biggest source of acquisition for HubSpot from a new business perspective. People either come in through Academy or the free products.
That's wild.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
But again, that's a massive macro example of what we're talking about. They first though, HubSpot first, they didn't like build a community. They built attention through the blog, right? They built attention. They built an audience. It's like, okay, now we have an audience. Do you want to go further? Do you want to commit? Like, and we built HubSpot Academy where you don't have to be a HubSpot user to sign up for it. You could become a member, a learner, a student in Academy, just being anyone.
Yeah. It's the discrete, what you're talking about before, building the discrete community. People have to put work into it, become a partner, and making that available to someone who is not just a customer. So someone could go through it and they could still go do everything on their own and not use HubSpot. They could stitch together a bunch of other products and tools and you're like welcoming them in.
Yeah.
Which ultimately results in like way more advocates, way more people talk about the business, way more people caring about the brand.
Yeah, and our mission, we taught this to all like HubSpot Academy kind of students and community members. So literally, I still remember this. I will never forget this. Our purpose is to educate and inspire people so that we together transform the way the world does business. They still use that today in like in their core message.
I feel like I want to salute you after that.
Yeah. That came together in 2012 or 13. So, yeah.
That's awesome. Okay, Mark, we're going to go to Wildcard. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. What is your go-to karaoke song?
Jump by Van Halen.
What's a movie you could watch again and again?
Ooh, I'll say Top Gun.
Top Gun original or Maverick?
No, original. No, fuck.
Oh wow, I'm a big Maverick guy myself.
Oh, jeez, Chris, come on.
What's your dream job other than your current one?
Good question. I have multiple. Can I say multiple answers?
Of course.
You can say all of them.
I'd like to own a ski resort, even though it's a very terrible business model. I'd like to, because so in high school, I invented a snowmaking machine for use in my house. So I used to own the domain home.
Wait, what?
Yeah, it's a whole other story, but like I used to own like homesnowmaking.com. This was back in like 1999. I used to have a small business called Snowscape. So like I want to like own a ski resort one day. I would also...
Wait, hold on.
You're so the snow
you
had
a
man?
Snow. You made a snow machine that you like would make snow in your yard or something?
It's very easy. All you need is an air compressor, a water supply,
it's so easy.
And just like probably $100 from Home Depot, and you got yourself a snow machine, a snow gun. Yeah.
And you don't sell this anymore?
No, no, no. I worked for a company that makes some of the biggest snow machines in the world based in Natick, Massachusetts. It used to be called Snow Economics. Now it's called HKD Snowmakers. And they created one that's called the Backyard Blizzard, which I worked on. And you can Google all this. You can find them. And,
I'm very intrigued by this.
Yeah. Backyard Blizzard, HKD. But yes, so I'll just leave it at that. That I have other ones, but like that's I would like to own a ski resort one. Yeah.
Listen, if we don't solve climate change, you might have to.
I think there's a lot of people
who would
right now be going out if they realize this is possible and buying home snow machines. Like I think that's become. There's more demand for that now than I think there probably ever was.
No, but the problem is you need a 28 degree wet bulb temperature, which takes into account the actual temperature plus relative humidity.
So it has to be cold.
It's got to be below freezing, and it's got to it's got to be about 28, 30 degrees for the scientific process of the compressed air supercooling the water to actually freeze in enough time before it hits the ground.
I love this.
Chris is that a
we've had a lot of extremely cold winters actually with no snow, so this is I'm going to put this on the list.
I can build one right now. We could do some video content. I could come over to the Wistia office.
Can you just, imagine the content we can create with this? It's insane.
So good.
It literally would take me under 1 hour to build one of these things.
That's so funny. I will take you up on that. Mark, thank you so much for joining us. Where can people connect with you?
Definitely find me on LinkedIn. TACinsider.com is our community. TACnetwork.com is our media network. But yeah, TAC, just Google TAC and you'll find us.
Cool. Thanks so much, Mark.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Mark.
Mark is a passionate man. Like, I've known him for so long and he's always been like this. You meet this guy in person, he's wild, he's off the wall. Like, I remember one time I saw him, ran into him actually, now I'm remembering, I ran into him when he was working at Drift. He's like, Savage, what's up? Oh my God. He's like, we should do a LinkedIn Live right now. I'm like, what's LinkedIn Live? It was like brand new. He's like, let's go. And we like jumped into a room and like went live and just started having a conversation. And then it's like, that was great. And I was like, that's how that guy operates. It's pretty fun.
That tracks. That makes sense. He's just like, yeah, off the cuff. Let's go. We're digging in. The stuff about HubSpot Academy was wild to me. I know that came like at the end. So I hope listeners, viewers, you stuck with it, but just what it takes to build an audience and what it takes to build like another revenue engine. I don't know. That was.
Well, what's interesting about that, I think, is like he said something there that I had forgotten, which was that HubSpot Academy was not just for HubSpot customers.
Right.
And that, I think, is the counterintuitive piece because most people think, oh, I have a customer now. I'll do great customer success. I'll spend a lot of time with them. I'll make sure they're really successful in this change they're trying to create. And that was like a twist, which was, hey, I want people to be successful at this change before they show up as a customer. And they're going to commit to a lot of time and effort to kind of prove that they can do this change. And that was one of the key moments that drove folks coming in to be customers. And I imagine, I would bet if you would look at that, you'd probably see, like if you cohorted early classes, there'd be some conversion rate at the beginning of like people completed the academy and then signed up. But I would bet if you looked like 3-4 years out, a lot of those people from that first group in the same company or new companies then later signed up. For HubSpot. So, because the brand trust that you build in something like that is so huge and can live on for so long. It's just very, that was really cool because I don't think that's been talked about that much.
Yeah, it felt kind of new. And people led GTMs. I mean, I guess that's not new per se, but like really hammering in the point that you can't go to market alone.
Yeah. The idea is not new, as we talked about. It's like in B2C. And the truth is like basically every major big company you know really well, like you've heard about who the CEOs are. We understand their personalities. I do all these interviews and we try to guess how the company's going to do based on the person. That's not new. I think it is extremely new and probably an incredibly small fraction of B2B companies that are thinking about this a lot. working a lot on this. And we are seeing companies do this now. There are influencers and creators in the B2B space. They are the earliest scratching of the surface here. And I do think it's existed for a while. It's just the bet that I think Mark is making is, and I agree with, is that the opportunity is going to grow tremendously. So, you know, when you think about like who speaks at conferences, we've had B2B conferences forever, and the people speaking at them, they're creators or influencers. It's just for a lot of times it's been like executives or it's been consultants who are doing this. And I think that what I'm saying, and I think what Mark is saying, it's going to be a third group where they're not just like an executive inside of a company.
Right.
And they're not, or like an expert inside of a company. And they're not just a consultant who only does this, but like the real thing they're selling is services. I think there's going to be a group of people who the real thing that they're selling is access to their audience. And their audience follows them because they're an expert on the thing. So they don't have to consult. They scale their consulting through the content. That's, I think, the difference.
I like it. I dig it. I agree.
Yep. Well, there we go. We did it again. Thanks for joining us here at Talking Too Loud. So glad you stuck with us. Please don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you see the content. And follow us on LinkedIn. I think LinkedIn is where we're having a lot of active conversations, talking about the show, clips from the show, other events with folks who that come on Talking Too Loud. So that's a great place to find us. And we hope to see you soon.
Smash that like button.
Smash it. Bye-bye.
Talking Too Loud is brought to you by Wistia, hosted by Chris Savage, produced by me, Sylvie Lubau, along with Adam Day. Executive produced by Wistia Studios. This episode was mixed by Maria Passingham of Edit Audio. Listen to Talking Too Loud wherever you listen to podcasts. And hey, rate and review us wherever you listen. And check out more content from Wistia Studios at wistia.com.